And as we conclude our series on comparing religions, let us be reminded of the text just read in your hearing, Romans 1. And I'll read verses 18 to 20 again, pertinent to our topic. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. The Greek poet Sophocles composed what is generally acknowledged to be a classic Oedipus Rex, or Oedipus the King. Everyone should read it because it has personified an aspect of human nature that speaks through the centuries to our own day. Oedipus was the son of King Laius, a fictional kingdom of Greece long ago, and the fates tell him that this babe will grow up to kill him, so he orders his wife to kill the boy. She's loath to do so, and so assigns the task to her handmaid, who instead sets him out on a hill to die by exposure, which was a common way of killing infants, unwanted infants in that day. Christians, by the way, parenthetically, would go out and retrieve those children. He is taken in, then, Oedipus, by a shepherd and raised as the shepherd's own son. When Oedipus learns from the oracle at Delphi that the fates have determined that he will kill his father and marry his mother, he flees Corinth, assuming the oracles refer to his adoptive parents, which is all that he knew. In his flight, he meets a man on the road who will not yield his chariot to Oedipus's right of way. A vehement argument ensues in which, when the stranger moves to strike the insolent youth, Oedipus leaps from his chariot and kills the man. Who do you think was the old man? Correct. It was his biological father, Laius. He later unknowingly marries his mother, Jocasta, fulfilling the prophecy, although, as one commentator puts it, none of the characters knows it. Now, Sophocles intended his play to underscore the authority of the oracle at Delphi and the inevitability of fate, no matter what man tried to do to escape it. But there are also corollary motifs upon which others have seized. Freud, of course, Sigmund Freud, most famously, developed his famous Oedipus complex, in which boys subliminally want to sleep with their mothers and are in competition with their fathers for her affection and attention. Culturally, it has been observed that almost every great empire of history is eventually destroyed by the sons or the offspring or like cultures that they spawn. Every civilization carries within it the seeds of its own destruction in this sense, in which the culture rises up to destroy itself eventually. Mark Twain says this in his essay, Eruption. He says, every civilization carries the seeds of its own destruction, and the same cycle shows in them all. He was a student of history, was Twain. He goes on to say, the republic is born, flourishes, decays into plutocracy, and is captured by the shoemaker whom the mercenaries and millionaires make into a king. The people invent their oppressors. Twain was very perceptive in this, a student of history, a student of republics. He says, the people invent their oppressors, and the oppressors serve the function for which they are invented, unquote. Behold, O American Laius, your Oedipus, the progressive. He is your son, and he will slay you. Behold, O American Republic, your fruit gone to seed. The plutocracy spawned and oppressing you, the modern progressive. How can I maintain this, you might say? Well, You have on your outline there, in your bulletin, a three-point outline. We're concluding our series on comparing religions today. And I have chosen then for this last message, progressivism and Christianity. And we've asked three questions of every religion we've treated. Who or what do I worship? How am I saved? And what are my fruits? So we will ask this of the religion of progressivism today. First of all, point one, progressivism and Christianity. Who or what do I worship? A little elusive when it comes to the progressive, but we can get some insight nevertheless today. This is the last in our summer series, then, comparing religions. Next week, I will begin an exposition of the book of Romans in the series, A Righteousness from God. Romans, the quintessence of saving doctrine, as one commentator has put it. Romans, the quintessence of saving doctrine. What is quintessence? You students, you young ones, maybe you can go home and mom and dad can tell you what quintessence is in the car on the way home. And maybe they're on their phones now looking, their iPhones now looking up what quintessence means themselves. Huh? But today, let's compare this last religion, progressivism, with Christianity. Now, of all the remaining religions that we could have chosen, why this one? And who says it's a religion anyway? Progressivism, huh? Two reasons why I want to bring this before you today. First of all, progressivism is the shiny object that distracts conservative puppies. Progressivism is the shiny object that distracts conservative puppies. We have a little kitten now at home, just a little thing, and if I'm tired of her scratching at my feet or something, I just toss a dime onto the floor and it rolls a little ways and she goes after it and I'm not bothered anymore. That's precisely what the idea of progressivism does to conservatives. Progressivism is a religion that masks itself as a secular political philosophy in the exact same way that Mormonism is a polytheistic pagan fertility cult that makes itself look like a Christian denomination. Just when conservatives are hot on the trail of a practice like abortion that kills far more black babies, for example, than white babies, blacks are 14% of the population in America, but they account for over 40% of abortions. Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, was a deeply racist woman. Well, just when progressives are hot on the trail of this, progressives merely bring out their bauble and they decry conservative critics as racists and anti-woman because they want to deprive them of their God-given right to choose. And so, like the puppy or the kitten chasing the shiny bauble while ignoring the steak on the table, conservatives go chasing after this bright bauble of racist and sexist and try to explain and apologize and weep in shame while ignoring the non sequitur nature of the argument and the complete faith of the progressive in his belief, despite the facts. Secondly, we've chosen progressivism to compare with Christianity, because honest progressives admit that theirs is a religion. Honest progressives, that's not an oxymoron. There are indeed honest progressives. They're beginning to admit that theirs is a religion. Now, perceptive conservatives have asserted this for a long time. People like Ann Coulter, who wrote a book, Godless, establishing progressivism, as another man I'm very high on, David P. Goldman, as well. He's written several books treating this, and Jonah Goldberg, too. All of these have brought before conservatives, hey, we're dealing with a de facto religion here. Let's treat it as such. But only recently have progressives attempted to make a case for religious atheism, as one author calls it. Another seeming oxymoron, isn't it? Religious atheism. there are two such men that I'll be referring to who have been expressly articulate, particularly articulate, if you will, in explaining these things. Two men, Joseph Bottom, who has written a book, An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America. He's treating of progressivism. And another one named Ronald Dworkin, who has written a book published posthumously. He didn't write it posthumously. It was published posthumously, and it was called Religion Without God, a progressive, ultra-liberal, if we can call him that. These are the two men I'll refer to primarily because they're honest and articulate about their religion. So how is then the religion of progressivism defined? Dworkin says, many millions of people who count themselves atheists have convictions and experiences very like and just as profound as those that believers count as religious. It's kind of a Me Too-ism that you'll be hearing. They say that though they do not believe in a personal God, that is, religious atheists, though they do not believe in a personal God, they nevertheless believe in a force in the universe greater than we are. What does that make you think of right away, right? A little blue haze around the characters in Star Wars, right? In a force, and he's serious about this. He then goes on to quote Albert Einstein, who he thinks shares this view. Einstein said, this knowledge, this feeling is at the center of true religiousness. In this sense, and in this sense only, Einstein says, I belong in the ranks of devoutly religious men. Unquote. So we so far have a force and a religious feeling. It is this shared religious feeling concerning a force that sits at the core of progressive notions of religion. Bottom, who tries to maintain his objectivity here in treating of this, Bottom characterizes the progressive God as a, quote, deistical clockmaker, an impersonal prime mover, a demiurge instead of a redeemer, unquote. So, in doing my reading and trying to glean something to grasp onto in terms of substance, I have just come up with this insipid, amorphous force, and it seems to be fine with progressives. And it gives them flexibility on issues, too. So flexible, in fact, that many progressives can ostensibly assert that they are of another religious persuasion while simultaneously confessing the progressive faith. The progressive inconsistently waves his Presbyterian baptism certificate in your face while simultaneously signing a certificate of abortion for their daughters, in a manner of speaking. His real faith is not in the Bible or Presbyterian confessions and catechisms, but rather in current political consensus. One reviewer of Bottom's book, Anxious America, says this, and I quote David P. Goldman, who is very perceptive. He says, America's consensus culture, and he talks about America having and being a consensus culture and how important it is for the progressive to be a part of that consensus. America's consensus culture is the unmistakable descendant of the old Protestant mainline. And here, this is why we're going parenthetically, why we're treating of church history in the course. We could probably spend an entire year on American church history because indeed the progressive, modern progressive, is a direct descendant of the Protestant progressive of the late 19th, early 20th century. He says, America's consensus culture is the unmistakable descendant of the old Protestant mainline. In particular, the social gospel promulgated by Walter Rauschenbusch. Now, I know Rauschenbusch because I took American church history in seminary as well and loved it. Now, Rauschenbusch is indeed one of the fathers of progressivism, a pastor, a reverend. In particular, the social gospel promulgated by Walter Rauschenbusch before the First World War and adapted by the liberal majority in the mainline denominations during the 20s. This is one reason why the mainline denominations have gone to seed in terms of their faith. Whereas Catholics make an examination of conscience before confession, I love this, Goldman hears. Goes on to say, whereas Catholics make an examination of conscience before confession, today's progressives examine their place in the social structure of oppression and then vow to reform society. That is what it means to have a social gospel without the gospel. Indeed, we have, with the progressive, a social gospel without the gospel. To be motivated by religious impulses, but believe it's entirely secular. Unquote. Yes, the progressive is motivated by religious impulses, but he believes it's entirely secular. Now, Dworkin tries to make a common ground with Christians by affirming two articles of faith he thinks that we share. Those two articles of faith, number one, human life has intrinsic value. Number two, nature has intrinsic value and is awesome. And that's not the trite awesome of the trendies either. He means genuine awe evoked by, say, the Grand Canyon. He uses the Grand Canyon as an example. And he says, you religious people experience awe and wonder looking at the Grand Canyon and you attribute it to God. Well, we have this, the Me Too thing, right? We too have feelings of awe and wonder. We just don't have a personal God that we attribute it to. So we're just as religious as you, only without God. He goes on to establish, in his own mind, that these things are true because we have faith that they are. He's trying to ring the bells of commonality with religion and Christianity by using words like faith. We have faith that they're true, and we do too, though we cannot prove them objectively. It is our faith that makes them true, he says. Therefore, since we share faith in these things, we can move on together, O conservative, arm in arm, singing kumbaya. He then goes on to argue for a system of acting on these articles of faith as a religion without God. Goldman goes on to say, the extended argument of religion without God, including Dworkin's approving references to his previous book and arguments, makes clear that the religious attitude, as he understands it, compels protection of abortion and also leads inexorably to progressive views about affirmative action, assisted suicide, same-sex marriage, right on down the line, unquote. So what this progressive and others like him who try to advance a social gospel without the gospel, a religion without God. What this progressive is like the Christmas tree salesman who's hawking his wares in July, long after the initially green tree has been cut off from its roots and ground. He has a religion cut off from its roots and ground. It doesn't take long for it to brown, dry, and crinkly with its needles shedding with every breeze of change. Yet he tries vainly to say, me too, I have a tree, though he has contempt for the garden from which it came. He is indeed Oedipus slaying his father. Goldman goes on to say, Dworkin conceals his disparagement of traditional biblical faith. And as I read his first chapter of his book this week, that was my sense. He's just barely concealing his contempt for traditional biblical faith. Goldman goes on to say, he purports to put forward a neutral conception of religion that captures the experience and axiom of believers and non-believers, even as he decisively tilts the playing field against biblical faith by disconnecting the dignity of the individual and the value and wonder of the world from belief in God. One of my favorite theologians, Cornelius Van Til, insightfully observed that the atheist must borrow from the Christian worldview in order to be coherent at all. He must borrow the language of God and religion to deny it, doesn't he? He has to make presuppositions on Christian religion, on the God of the Bible, to deny it. Ah, theist, the very word theist employed there has to be used to be coherent at all for the atheist. He must first suppress the innate knowledge that he has of God and then erect another in his place, even as we have seen from Romans chapter 1. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. That is human nature since our first parents, Adam and Eve. We have indeed within us a built-in suppressor, if you will, to suppress the truth evident before us. Paul goes on to say, for what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they're without excuse. Indeed, the religious atheist is without excuse for calling himself an atheist, because he is unrighteously suppressing the truth by nature. No wonder he doesn't see the living God. This is precisely what the progressive has done. Yet it is the believer who inherits and cherishes original wonder. Right? As David says, I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well, David says. And we know that as well, do we not? In confessing the living God, it is not an insipid wonder and awe that we have, because we know the living God who made it. Well, this is, as slippery as it may be, this is the notion the progressive has of God, if he has one at all. The fool says in his heart, as the psalm said today, there is no God. Well, secondly, we ask of the religions we're looking at, how am I saved? There is a soteriology. Soteriology is the doctrine of how am I saved. There is a soteriology to every religion. There's an aching need every soul has, an aching need that religion attempts to answer, every religion worth its salt. How am I saved? The very term progressive comes to us from the late 19th, early 20th century. Progressives at that time were Christians motivated by the gospel to effect social change. Walter Rauschenbusch being the theologian of that social gospel. One of my favorite characters, William Jennings Bryan. And this is a character, if you're homeschooling your kids, worth looking at, spending a week or two studying. William Jennings Bryan, for example, preached tirelessly for temperance and peace and going off the gold standard, too. He was one of the main preachers of going off the gold standard so that the common man could have more cash and credit as well. One of his favorite themes was, the working man is being crucified on a cross of gold, he would say. He would mop his brow. The working man is being crucified on a cross of gold because he cannot get the credit that the big businessman can. Eventually, he became President Wilson's Secretary of State, holding out for peace until the outbreak of World War I. He resigned because he thought that Wilson was being disingenuous in seeking war when he said on the surface that he was not. And I agree with Brian on that. Billy Sunday was preaching tirelessly to save souls, persuade men to give up on demon rum. Dwight L. Moody traversed the country by train, filling auditoriums for his evangelistic messages and social reform. And the culmination of progressivism. What was the culmination of progressivism? The 18th Amendment. Should I tell you what that is, or should we have our homeschool students go home and look it up, huh? What was the 18th Amendment? It was prohibition, wasn't it? The banning of the production and consumption of alcohol. Well, then later repealed by the 21st Amendment by FDR. Who Goldman says that FDR, who liked his martinis dry but not the country, put an end to prohibition. Well, for the progressives then, it all came falling down around their ears. The war to end all wars, World War I, broke out. Failure of peace, the miserable failure of prohibition. Then the onset of the Great Depression, despite going off the gold standard, put a stake through the heart of progressivism. Until Ronald Reagan put a stake in the heart of liberalism. Then some bright liberal got the idea of opening the coffin of progressivism again, yanking out that stake, and voila, progressivism has come back to life. When asked if she were a liberal, Hillary Clinton said, I quote Hillary, "I prefer the word progressive, which has a real American meaning, going back to the progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century. I consider myself a modern progressive, someone who believes strongly in individual rights and freedoms. So I consider myself a proud American progressive, and I think that's the kind of philosophy and practice that we need to bring back to American politics," unquote from Hillary Clinton. So inherent then in progressivism is not only a theology, as insipid as it may be, but also a soteriology. How am I saved? Well, first of all, if you're going to be saved, you have to know what you're being saved from. So progressivism has an understanding of sin as well. That from which we must be saved, that is sin. Goldman says again, "For the post-Protestants," I'm quoting him now, "for the post-Protestants, sin is the social forces of bigotry, power, corruption, mass opinion, militarism, and oppression as the constant themes of history against which they must array themselves." By redefining sin as social sin, he says, Rauschenbusch raised up a new Satan and a new vocabulary of redemption from Satan's snares. According to Bottom, his central demand is to see social evil as really existing evil. This is an insight into the mind and the thinking of the progressive. Indeed, they see social evil as really existing evil, a supernatural force of dark magic. Do you see why they hate us as conservatives? He goes on to say that Rauschenbusch holds that Jesus did, in a very real sense, bear the weight of the public sins of organized society, not the individual sin of the sinner, but rather the weight of public sins of organized society. And they, in turn, are causally connected with all private sins. That's why they can attribute evil for your political opinions to you. Well, then, to have a soteriology is to have a way of salvation from this sin. How is the progressive saved from his social sins? Goldman goes on to say, "What sustains the heirs of the now defunct Protestant consensus is a sense of the sacred. But a sense of the sacred that seeks the security of personal salvation through assuming the right stance on social and political issues." Personal salvation is your right political views. And if you don't have the right political views, then obviously you're not saved and you're evil. You are still dead in your sin. Goldman goes on to say, "Precisely because the new secular religion permeates the pores of everyday life, it sustains the certitude of salvation," that is, holding the right political views, "and a self-perpetuating spiritual aura." This is where we get that sense of disdain and pride from the progressive in his political views, just because he holds them, not having to rationally justify them, but just in the holding of them. That self-perpetuating spiritual aura that hangs about them. This is why progressives can look with disdain at conservatives who hold the wrong perspective, and why it does no good to rationally talk through issues, show the results of poverty programs. The more you spend on programs, the more you get of those ills. The more we spent on poverty, the more poverty we got, right? But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether policies actually work or not. The progressive feels good about it, and because his intentions are good, affirmative action, welfare, helping those who are poor, food stamps, higher taxes to redistribute wealth, carbon taxes to save the planet. Because he feels good about it, because his intentions are good, he's right and moral and good. Bottom says in his book, we live in a spiritual age when we believe ourselves surrounded by social beings of occult and mystic power. When we live with titanic cultural forces contending across the sky, and our moral sense of ourselves, of whether or not we are good people, of whether or not we're saved. When that moral sense of ourselves takes its cue primarily from our relation to those forces. We live in a spiritual age when the political has been transformed into the soteriological, right? The political has been transformed into how we are saved. When how we vote is how our souls are saved. Now, conservatives can lapse into that perspective from time to time as well, can't they? But for the progressives, it's an article of faith. How I vote is how I'm saved. Utterly opposite, of course, to biblical Christianity, as we've seen. And as we'll see, as we unpack the book of Romans, Paul says, now the righteousness of God, demonstrating, first of all, how important it is to be righteous before God, has been manifest apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. Personal righteousness comes first before God. For there is no distinction, Paul says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. This is biblical soteriology, not social gospel soteriology, where how I vote is how I'm saved. No, it's how God votes on your behalf to cleanse you from your sin, or no. This Jesus Christ, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time, so that he may be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. This is biblical soteriology, not social gospel soteriology. Well, progressivism and Christianity, then we must also consider, what are my fruits? Every religion bears fruit, does it not? And we see the fruits of progressivism all around us. The philosopher Francis Fukuyama has coined a term called, this he attributes to progressives, megalothemia. He calls it megalothemia. It's a takeoff on megalomania, right? The idea of grasping all the cords of power into one's own hands. Only megalothemia is a compulsive need to feel superior to others. This is one of the complaints, of course, that conservatives have with progressives. One of the beefs we have with them, right? Is that they always seem to have this compulsive need to feel superior to conservatives or Christians or others who do not hold the right political opinions, whether they're justified or not. One author has written a great article, Progressives, Puritans with a Different God. And he, of course, compares the puritanical nature, oppressive puritanical nature now of progressives with the Puritans of old. Secondly, we are also left a spirituality of the undead, as one author has put it, a spirituality of the undead. Bottom does this in a very effective manner. He notes our obsession with the horror genre. One out of eight films now being produced are of the horror genre. There is a spirituality, but it's a spirituality of the undead. That stake being pulled out of the corpse of the undead back to life is the progressive. And also he treats of the death of art, too, even as much as Francis Schaeffer has done. Indeed, as a culture dies, the art dies as well, does it not? And then thirdly, we inherit a dying culture as well. Bottom with Goldman says, and I quote, fertility rates. And once again, Goldman has written an entire book on this, talking about the death of the West in terms of its loss of fertility rates. Fertility rates among members of secularized mainline churches are so low, he says, as they are among progressive Jews, that one is tempted to regard post-Protestantism as a one-generation wonder. While the children of the mainline occupy themselves with yoga, organic gardening, and expanded gender identities, popular culture becomes moribund, he says, that is, it dies. And then C.S. Lewis as well has coined a term that characterizes progressives as chronological snobbery, he calls it, chronological snobbery. The whole idea inherent is in progress is that you're making progress according to a standard and you're moving forward and actually improving things. But he says it is the identification or confusion of change with progress. Lewis says, it is the uncritical assumption that whatever has gone out of date is on that count discredited. You must find out why it went out of date, though, he says. Was it ever refuted, and if so, by whom, where, and how conclusively, or did it merely die away as fashions do? If the latter, this tells us nothing about its truth or falsehood. From seeing this, one passes to the realization that our own age is also a period and certainly has, like all periods, its own characteristic illusions. Very insightful on Lewis's part. He goes on to say, they are likeliest to lurk in those widespread assumptions which are so ingrained in the age that no one dares to attack or feels it necessary to defend them. An insight, though he predated the progressive, an insight into their hearts and minds. The fruit of progressivism we see amongst us, do we not? Not only in these things, but also in failed policy. But that doesn't matter, once again, does it? Failed policies that will breed a failing country, for that matter, as well. Well, brothers and sisters, the fruits of Christianity, indeed, progressivism is a biblical Christianity gone to seed. If that indeed is the case, then I suggest we return to a biblical Christianity, which helped to form and shape our culture and our land and our traditions in the West to begin with. If we indeed we do, then we will find a rebirth not only of the biblical faith, but also, I would submit to you, of culture and our republic as well. Seed the world with Christian republics, but we need to begin here in order to do so. Pray for our nation. Indeed, pray for the biblical faith of this nation as well. May we indeed see a rebirth of it. Towards that end, let us come to the table of grace to be filled with grace as we participate in the Supper of the Lord.